Ready? I want to continue or build or do something similar to a theme that I talked about at the last one-day sitting, which is choiceless awareness. And choiceless awareness is often described, or talked about, not often, but sometimes in the Vipassana tradition, as being the description of what mature mindfulness looks like. That when you really understand what mindfulness is, you understand that it becomes choiceless, where awareness opens up to all realms of possible experience. The normal ways in which we fixate the mind are released, and we're able to kind of settle the attention carefully but fully on each thing that arises, but in a completely free way without being fixed or stuck anywhere. It's kind of like developing, it's like the principle that if you notice that there's a difference between, for example, thinking and being aware that you're thinking, knowing that you're thinking. The noticing, the knowing capacity of the mind is what we're cultivating in mindfulness. Not thinking more about things, but rather there's this ability to notice and know. And it's that ability to notice and know that we're freeing up in mindfulness and be able to shine freely and wonderfully on all things that arise in a kind of way that becomes choiceless. The expression choiceless awareness was taken, as far as I know, was coined by Krishnamurti. And I read recently that Krishnamurti apparently had a method is not the right word, but he had somewhat of a method in the way he gave talks. I don't know if this is true, but this is what this editor of his works claimed. And that was when he started giving a talk, apparently he would always start by talking about listening, how you listen to a talk. Because here, that's what people were doing. So rather than kind of talking about something, you know, different than what they were doing, he would start with actually what they were doing, which there's there to listen, to have a conversation. And he would talk about the nature of listening. And he would warn people or tell people about how often we listen with a lot of baggage. Our attention is loaded. There's a lot of, sometimes we listen with expectations, we listen with prejudice, we listen with hope, we listen with fear, we listen with distraction, we listen with eagerness. There's many ways in which our attention is colored or loaded attention, which he wanted to warn the audience for. And what he was trying, I think, to point to was the ability to listen in a choiceless way, to have this experience of choiceless awareness. In Mahayana Buddhism, they teach a lot of, sometimes they teach a lot of visualization practices. And in the early Mahayana, early Mahayana sutras, they give these grandiose descriptions of magical displays that either happen through visualizations of your own or through the magical interventions of different Buddhas and stuff that kind of want to help you out. And it's amazing descriptions of, of cosmic worlds and palaces and deities and heavens and shining Buddhas with infinite number of halos shining in infinite number of ways. And it's just phenomenal. You know, it puts Walt Disney to shame. And so they create this huge, you know, world. And then at some point, someone snaps their fingers and it all disappears. And usually the practitioner then kind of goes, gee, you know, what happened? Where did it all go? And where did it all come from? And it all comes from the creation of the mind. And it becomes a very dramatic lesson in this Mahayana tradition of the power of the mind to create a reality for itself, and then for us to get pulled into that reality and think it's the whole reality until something happens. And we say, Jesus, where was I? You know, what happened here? I was lost, or I was completely separate or gone. And this is considered, this is a very important technique for getting people to wake up in some traditions. In mindfulness practice, we don't do visualization practices, and your teachers don't kind of, you know, conjure up great visions for you to kind of snap you out of. But rather, we just pay attention, you know, to something as simplistic as our own mind and our own reality. But it's very much like that. And there's a great place that we see that in the Vipassana, especially on retreats. It's talked about a lot. You've probably heard the expression. is called Vipassana Romances and Vipassana Vendettas. And often people talk about them. They talk about the five hindrances and how they work and all that, and how you have to be on the lookout for it so you don't get kind of swept up or sucked up into this world of imaginary romance. But actually, I think it can be also be used as a very powerful teaching of how the mind can create or project a reality onto something that's completely inappropriate or completely it's different. The reality is really different than what you think it is. I remember when I had a Vipassana romance. Maybe a better word is a virtual romance. Virtual romance. And you get the flavor of it. Because what happens on Vipassana retreats, no one talks to each other. And you're sitting there very quiet, talking to people for days and days. And there's no input of any serious, normal kinds of inputs we have, sensory inputs and sensual inputs. And there's no distractions except what you create for yourself. And so we create a lot of things. And some of us, have sometimes a tendency towards thinking about romance or sex or whatever your choice. And other people think about all things they hate and they have aversions. And so it's phenomenal. You someone walks in front of you and you see their socks and you just can't stand them because of the socks they wear. And it's not so, it's a serious because somehow the mind is very, very concentrated and very, very still and quiet and vulnerable and sensitive on retreat that actually things that normally you wouldn't even notice can loom quite large on a retreat. Their socks, or the way they serve themselves at the meal table, buffet table. I mean, it's like, how could they have the nerve of serving themselves that way? And then you kind of think you hate them and everything about them you don't like and, it just builds. Virtual vendettas. But then when I was on one retreat, I remember it was a long retreat, and there was this woman who seemed very nice, and and so my mind was fertile and creative, and it wasn't. I had 3 months to do it in, but. I wasn't obsessed about it exactly, but 3 months is, a long time to build a reality. And about who this woman was, and where she probably was from, and what kind of person she was, and how I'd be talking to her, and what we'd do afterwards, and all this stuff. So when the retreat was getting near the end, last week or so, in a very controlled way, we ended silence. Not to kind of freely talk to each other, but first there was a day where there were some questions and answers with the teachers. So people started asking questions in the hall, which they never did. So you started hearing people's voices. So this woman raised her hand and asked a question. And she had this really thick foreign accent. And I realized that she had, I didn't have a clue who she was. And everything I've been thinking about for 3 months, was just kind of the whole edifice, the whole palace, the whole, vanished like that. And I realized how much what I saw in her and who I thought she was, what I really saw in that face and everything was really, my projection. It was what I brought to the situation. And so many times our attention, or how we pay attention or what we add into our attention, the way we interpret what we perceive, is full of baggage with expectations, opinions, fears, ideas. And much of what's called in modern Western psychology, I guess, is called projection, could be called perhaps in Buddhism by the word papancha, prapancha in Sanskrit, a word which has been difficult to translate into English. One of the translations has been proliferation of thoughts. Another is multiplicity. The way the Buddhists, because they don't have the language of projection exactly, how they talk about it is it's how we tinge or color the way in which we perceive an object so that we see in the object what isn't there. So that's, projection is good enough, I guess, but this is called papancha. And papancha means, you know, it has different meanings, but that's the primary one, this kind of projection, this adding into reality what isn't there, and then seeing it in reality, assuming that it's really there. And usually when the Buddha talks about this, he usually describes the process of perception that builds up to that. So he says, first there's just, you know, there's a, you know, a sound, and you hear a sound. And there's a contact of the sound with your ears, and you have sound consciousness arises, and you're aware of the hearing. And then there's a feeling of, next thing that happens is a sense that's either pleasant or unpleasant, that sensation, that sound. And then building on that sensation and the pleasant, unpleasant of it, comes then a perception of what it might be, or what it is. And you might, you know, if most of you maybe think I'm hitting my hands together, but if you were sitting outside and didn't see me, maybe you wouldn't know what it was. But so you make this idea, you see it's the hands coming together, it's a clap, and that's a pretty reasonable interpretation or perception. And then based on kind of our perceptions and our ideas, which are tied into our memories and our associations and our feelings to some degree, but they're pretty simple, based on that, then we start a chain of associations, of associated thinking. And the chain of associated thinking, you know, gets very, very interesting. Because you hear a clap, but it, you know, it sounds like a gunshot, and you're wondering where to move to, and you're wondering whether moving to East Palo Alto is a good idea. But then you think, well, maybe I can't afford anywhere else, so maybe I'll go there anyway, and, you know, maybe it's, you know, I'm willing to deal with it, but maybe what kind of alarm should I get for my house? But then, you know, the expensive alarm system I can't really afford. And so what should I do about earning that? Maybe I should get a better job for myself. But it's hard to get a job in this environment. So, you know, you get pretty frustrated and think, well, maybe where else should I move? You know, where a job is easier? Well, maybe Texas. And well, then suddenly, you know, you don't need to get that alarm anymore because in Texas, maybe it's a lot safer. But wait a minute. All you did was hear a clap of the hand. And so the chain of association goes off like that. So that's kind of the beginning of this papancha, this proliferation of thinking. And it takes us away into very abstract thinking, which has nothing, or almost nothing to do with our direct experience of what's happening now. And the sad thing is that often many people talk to each other from this abstraction to abstraction to abstraction, and it has nothing to do with what's going on right now, here and now. But then, you know, I clap again. And now, you know, you have had a chance maybe, and your idea of what a clap means has kind of entered into your consciousness, and now you hear it again, and you assume that my clap is a clap of approval. And so what you hear is you don't just hear a sound, but you hear a sound of approval. And that's when you begin to project into this experience itself, the idea of this is approval. And actually, it's just a clap. I'm not, you know, who knows why I'm clapping? I'm clapping to make a point. So that's maybe a small example. So, but the proliferation that happens can really color in a big way, proliferation of associated thinking, how we experience the raw sense data of what's actually being perceived. So it becomes these particular notions about the object of experience, which distort it with all kinds of associated thoughts and emotions, opinions. And these are largely unconscious projections, preconceived ideas, prejudices, identifications, desires, and so forth. And I think, you know, prejudice is a great example of this kind of activity. You meet someone who belongs to a certain category of being, and you already have a preconceived idea of that kind of being, that kind of person, and you assume that that person, you know, is that way. And, you know, I think all of us can think of examples. It's quite painful for some people in our society, and some women and some minorities, and just, you know, preconceived ideas that you're seen that way. It isn't simply people have an idea of who you are and then kind of know that it's an idea and know that you're different from the idea and, you know, give you the benefit of the doubt. They assume this is the way it is. That's prapancha working, projection. And these projections, these associated thinking, it can go from little bubbles in the mind to ripples, to roaring streams, to great big storms of thoughts, of activity. And in Buddhism, sometimes it's associated with, it's said to be a cyclic process, a cyclic process of samsara, where one kind of associated becoming of thinking then produces another one, associated thinking, another associated thinking. And there's a whole realm of they just kind of spinning around in circles and circles and circles. And we very seldom have a chance to break through that into our direct experience itself. There are five kinds of papancha that is talked about in Buddhism. There's that that's based on kamma, which is usually translated as sensual desire, but usually has a stronger meaning in Sanskrit. I think it usually means something more like lust or craving for sensual desire, desire for pleasure itself. And so, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't remember anymore about this woman on retreat whether, you know, if it was exactly lust that I was projecting, but it could have been, you know, and what I saw there, you know, who knows what I was seeing. But seeing desire where pleasure, where there isn't any, maybe no inherent pleasure there to begin with. I wonder sometimes about beer that we drink, because I think it tastes really awful. I think anybody who tastes it for the first time must think it's awful. How many tasted it for the first time? Every first time you ever tasted it and you thought, this is really great. There are some people. There are some people. Okay, great. Maybe there's more of you. Some of you don't want to admit it. But I think that most people, in my impression, the first time you taste it, it kind of doesn't taste so good. But something out, the pleasure of it is acquired. And maybe many things are like that. So the first one has to do with projections of thinking that there's pleasure inherent in the object itself. Whereas the pleasure comes from the way we interact with it, and it's not in the object itself. The second one has to do with views, opinions. So we have views of progress, for example, progress in a meditation practice. So we're having trouble today following our breath very well. So it doesn't accord with our view that we're supposed to be, you know, much further along in our concentration practice than, you know, we already are. So then we think, we project or we assume or we interpret our experience as being poor or bad, or we're bad. And there's nothing bad about us, it's just we have a view about it. So for example, we have the idea that I have a bad habit. That's a view, that's an opinion, which then can be projected onto me, and I can feel miserable because I assume I'm a person who am a bad habit, almost. It's who I am, I can't be separate myself from it. But what is the experience of a bad habit? Mindfulness is, the function of mindfulness is to cut through the projections and the abstractions to see clearly what is actually happening, that in the direct experience that we're then taking and constructing a palace, an edifice, a fantasy from. So a bad habit is, for example, you do something. And then you have this thought or a memory that you've done it before. And then you have this sense, this idea, that the fact that you've done it before and done it now, that means something. Okay, so it means something. So, and additionally, you have the thought that, and doing this thing again is bad. That all those things have to happen in a kind of in a sequence in order for you to come to the conclusion that I have a bad habit. So you have to do something. You have to have the idea that you've done it in the past. You have to have the idea that that there's meaning to this, and that meaning has either bad or it's good. And there you come to this grand conclusion that, you know, there's a bad habit, rather than just seeing things directly as they are. I think a great place to see a great place to see papancha is how we get spinning in the world of papancha is to see the difference between fear and worry. Because fear is many things, but there's kind of primal fear that can arise. The mountain lion jumps in front of you and, you know, you get afraid. That seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to be afraid of. But worry, as opposed to that kind of fear, is almost entirely, maybe completely, belongs to that world of a papancha. Belongs to that world of thoughts and ideas and associated thinking. Worry is usually not about what's happening directly, but usually we worry about something in the future or something far and distant from what's actually happening here and now. And so we enter into this world of imaginary thoughts of what ifs, or if only, or, and from that arises fear, worry, and that worry then becomes, and sometimes projection onto reality, onto experience itself. So there's the projection of fear, and that's connected, I think, also often to prejudice. And then there's a projection of mana, of conceit, onto things. This is the idea that, projection of the idea that of me and mine, that something is mine, or that it's me. That assume that some object is really yours to have. And, you know, the great tension perhaps that exists between parents and children, when some point when the parents have to realize that the children are not theirs, or they're not, you can't identify with them. I notice sometimes when children are quite young, there's a very strong identification between a parent and a child. And the parent might think, you know, doesn't think of themselves as separate from the child. But as the child gets older, there's sometimes a tension that arises there. And at some point, the parent has to realize that this is not me anymore, and let go of it. So the projection of me onto this person, projection of me onto my possessions, projection of me onto qualities of who we are. It's a great point in a person's mindfulness practice when they see that mental states arise and pass, and there's no need to identify them with me. That because I get angry, that's not necessarily me, it's just anger arising. I'm sad, it's just sadness, joy. And so there isn't a kind of strong identification which adds then a whole level, tends to add a whole level more of a pancha to the situation. Because if you assume, for example, that your depression is yours, and then I am depressed, and that's who I really am, then it's very easy to kind of make a next step and make a judgment about who you are. Well, being a depressed person maybe isn't such a good idea. You don't look like the Marlboro Man, or you don't look like, you know, the person on the commercial who's all bubbly. And so, therefore, you're not living up to expectations. You add a whole other level of stuff on top of it. So this thing of conceit, of me and mine, and then projection of aversion onto things. You know, the person has the socks I don't particularly like. It's unpleasant to look at those socks. And that's, you know, the experience. The projection is to take that raw experience and say, well, that person is, I hate, I don't like that person. Something wrong fundamentally with that person. And to find all kinds of things that are wrong with them. And it all started because of the socks they wore. It was really, when I was in the monasteries, there was, you know, a tremendous amount of bowing that happened. And we had, in Tassajara, we ate all our meals, most of the meals, in the meditation hall in a choreographed meditative way. There was, except for chanting, there was no one spoke to each other. And there were servers who came in. You didn't serve yourself. Your service came in, and you were sitting in meditative posture, and you had a bowl in front of you, and the servers would come in, and you would bow to the server, they would bow to you, and you'd lift up your bowl, and they'd fill it with food, and then you'd bow to them, and, you know. And, you know, it's a nice thing. Everybody's bowing to each other, and it's wonderful. That person didn't bow deeply enough. That was too casual. Every time that person comes, they don't seem to bow enough. And, you know, that person's bowing too much. And how could they overdo it, like, you know? And maybe more natural. And, you know, and the mind just goes off, you know. At least my mind did. You know, it's such a... idle minds. The mind that's full of prapancha tends to be a very crowded mind, and has very little room to listen, very little room to see anything new, to understand anything new, to understand the freshness of each moment as it arises. The notion of this phenomena of prapancha, of projection, wild, fantastic, associated thinking, is sometimes connected to control. And perhaps the opposite of control is to be choiceless in our awareness. And mindfulness itself, I would say, is the opposite of control, the opposite of projection. It's the opposite of fixation, the fixation of attention in a certain way. It's a free, non-judgmental recognition of what is happening without condemnation and without approval. Just, oh, this is what's happening. without the mind fixating. And this is something we can actually feel when the mind settles and fixates on something. And it happens to all of us all the time. We've all had the experience, you know, just in the last few minutes probably, but certainly in the sitting. You're sitting following your breath nicely, and after a while you notice that for the last 5 minutes you weren't following your breath. You were thinking about what you're going to have for dinner tomorrow. For those 5 minutes, the mind settled itself and the attention kind of went down that rut and got fixated on dinner tomorrow, on the menu or whatever was going on. This kind of activity happens all the time. Sometimes it happens quite effortlessly and doesn't really feel very strong, but sometimes when it's very compulsive and strong, it feels like a real grabbing hold, a kind of a real tightness of the mind, of awareness itself, a narrowing of awareness. The more sensitive we become in our mindfulness, the more sensitive we become to the subtlety of what fixation feels like, the unpleasantness of the mind fixating itself on something, rather than the mind being free to float freely as it wishes. You know, we talk sometimes about monkey mind. Monkey mind being the mind that is kind of scattered, jumping, fragmented, jumping all over the place, grabbing every possible thing that might arise. The monkey is someone who is never satisfied with any branch or any activity, but is never really willing to let go of anything, but also never really willing to give up any other opportunities, always grabbing and everything. So the monkey mind that we often sit down with, scattered, confused, agitated. The mind of mindfulness, of choiceless awareness, I kind of came up today with the notion that it's called, as opposed to the monkey mind, it's the bee mind. Like the bee, you know, like honeybees. The honeybee, maybe called the honeybee mind, that's a better expression. Because what the honeybee does is, the honeybee goes around freely and comes to a flower and doesn't pass the flower by, but kind of goes in there gently into the flower, attends carefully to the flower, and is free to go at any point, and then at some point when it's attended to fully, leaves and kind of goes around to the other one. So choiceless awareness doesn't just kind of casually gloss over everything, but rather it floats freely, and when it comes to something, something arises in our experience which is predominant, it settles there like a bee. A bee never damages or hurts or interferes, I suppose, the flower. It just kind of goes and buzzes around, and then it goes off to something else. And this experience in mindfulness of something arises and really being there, having awareness alert enough that you can notice when the mind goes off to a new direction and to bring the attention there. So we can really are noticing carefully what's actually happening. So we can dwell and rest in the awareness itself rather than in the object of awareness, fixated on the object of awareness. So if we see there's a difference between thinking and awareness of thinking, the awareness and knowing of thinking is not fixated. But some parts of ourselves, our fears, our worries, our ambitions, our desires and all that, grabs itself around our thought patterns, our particular thoughts. And so our attention in some ways gets locked. But the nature of awareness itself is really, really not ever locked. It's really free, it's open, it's not in itself the same thing as the fixation. So we can see the difference. So mindfulness is to come to a situation, see it clearly for what it is, but have the power of noticing, the power of knowing, the power of recognition strong enough so that our attention doesn't get locked by these accelerary kind of phenomena that locks it in place. To keep it fresh, to keep it present, to keep it fluid, hovering, like a bee, perhaps. I think it was Freud, or in psychoanalysis, they talk about a hovering mind, hovering attention you develop. Maybe he got it from the honeybees. And all of us, to some degree, are fixated by our thoughts. without really ever many of us thinking carefully about what is thoughts, but more importantly, what is the nature of our identification with thoughts. We take it so much for granted, it's almost like invisible, it's like the air we breathe. But actually you can investigate what is the nature of thinking and what's the nature of the identification, what's the nature of the relationship that we have with thinking. So some of you have heard my little way of teaching about how I find it quite amazing how interested I am all the time in my own thinking. If anybody else talked to me nonstop in the same way that I speak to myself, I would be begging for him to stop. I'll kill you, you know. I'd be completely bored because, you know, and it's so repetitive. I mean, my God. But, you know, anybody else repeats it as often. It's just like, give me a break. But I repeat it. No, it's like the first time. It's like, you know, this really counts. This is really important. You know, I've thought 92 times today, I thought that I'm a lousy person. Each time, you know, yes, yes. Any reasonable person would think, well, 92nd time, geez, you know. There's a little trick of the trade that some teachers teach. When people it works best when people are really self-critical, is to ask them to start counting how many times they're self-critical in a day. And often, when they come to 352, at some point they smile. And that changes the whole game. But so why is it that we kind of so fixated? And you might say, well, maybe it's the nature of the mind. But I wouldn't be so quick to say that, because the fixation, the compulsiveness, the degree of it changes a lot, depends on a lot of different conditions. It depends a lot on our emotional relationship, the prapancha with a certain situation, our fear of the situation, our anxiety, our desires, our identification with the situation. One thing is to think about tomorrow's menu for dinner, you know, casually because I like kind of food or just whatever. But then if, you know, all these people are coming over for dinner and, you know, this is, you know, it's like my boss is coming for dinner, right? And, you know, I better cook a good meal. If I don't cook a good meal, I mean, it has consequences. Suddenly the fear gets into play, and that fear adds a whole level of intensity to those thoughts about what kind of menu to have and how to cook. So there's a range of intensities to what goes behind our thinking. So the relationship we have with thoughts is a place we can see, is how are we caught, how are we fixated? Or is there an alternative to being fixated? Is there kind of a freedom and openness that can happen? Freud, I think, was really made major contributions to our culture. And one of the in relationship to what I'm talking about tonight, his idea of free association, Virginia Woolf and other artists took off from his ideas and applied those into art, free associated writing or free associated painting, and discovered a whole other level of expression, deep kind of has deep integrity, deep kind of coming out of the unconscious, that couldn't happen if we're always in control of our thoughts and our ideas. So to find some way to drop below the controlling aspect of the mind is actually very, very useful. And there's many ways to do that. You can do it by writing, by walking or running sometimes, by maybe swimming. You can do it sometime, but meditation actually, I believe, is one of the best ways to do it, because in meditation it allows the mind to go very, very deep below all the different levels of fixation that happens, ways in which we get controlling of our attention. But in different circumstances of our life, a different situation, I think different kinds of freeing up is appropriate. Sometimes I feel it's very appropriate for me to have a free associated thinking. If I'm working at home a lot, like all day, and I'm kind of very working on a paper, for example, the nature of working on a paper is, in a sense, to be fixated, to be kind of focused. I mean, that's appropriate in that situation. But what happens is, after a while, the mind kind of gets into that mode and kind of stuck there a little bit. And so then I go for a walk or go for a run. And what I find is that quickly my mind begins freeing itself up. And my thinking takes wonderful directions, and different things arise, and strange things, and wonderful things. And then at some point, because it's so free, at some point, new connections and new ideas begin arising in the very thing that I was writing about. It was almost as if I was, because of the way I was focused in my writing, I didn't give my mind a chance to think creatively. And I had to kind of find another way to be, to free up the mind so that creativity could flow again. And meditation does this also, but meditation is not free associated thinking. Because thinking itself, even though it can be, the thinking can be freely done, thinking itself is too easily, is a kind of stuckness of awareness in one particular realm, in the realm of thinking. And so when you sit in mindfulness, it becomes more choiceless, and you don't settle the mind anywhere, even in thoughts. And it's possible because awareness and thinking are two different things. We're much more than just thoughts. To be choiceless is not to be caught or have goals or expectations. It is to allow things to unfold in whatever darn way they want to unfold, which is pretty frightening sometimes. And I think it's very important for people to have some time during the day, some time during the week, where they give this kind of freeing up of control, they give up this kind of the surface mind of fixation, and find some freer way for the mind, for awareness to be. I think it's tremendously healing. It connects us with a great intimacy to ourselves. And I think that's many religious traditions offered that to people in the idea of sacred time that many traditions have. The idea of a Sabbath in Judeo-Christian traditions is kind of sacred time. Traditionally, you weren't supposed to work and do all these normal things. I think it's tremendously healing. You know, I have friends who work 7 days a week. They can't stop on the weekends. And so when you can't stop on the weekends with your work, the mind never gets a chance to relax, to open up to something wider. And then the final thing I'll say is that to discover the world of choiceless awareness is to enter into kind of a sacred world, sacred leisure, sacred time. But also, I think more importantly, it gives us the opportunity to connect our choices to the same sacred world. If we can be comfortable with a choiceless world, then out of that choiceless world, from that place which is not reactive, then there's opportunity perhaps to see more clearly what the situation is and allow choice to arise, maybe sometimes choicelessly, but choiceless choice. It's possible. And the last thing I'll say to end, I write a fair amount at various points. And the last time I was writing something, I realized in the middle of my writing that I wasn't supposed to, or I don't need to, know what I'm going to write before I write it. And that was so freeing. And it was like, and it became a metaphor for so many different areas of my life. I always thought I didn't have to know what I was going to write before I wrote it. When I wrote it, it was a surprise. It's since then, it's been a lot easier to write. So a choiceless choice. So I guess I had a lot more to say. I mean, I don't feel like I developed the theme very well. But anyway.
93.
Boy, what kind of audience is this? I guess I failed. So, have a choiceless week.